from runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 746, Culture During the Pandemic, with guest Tracy Brower. Recorded Thursday, October 15th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Today, my guest is Dr. Tracy Brower, who is a PhD sociologist and a principal at Steelcase's Applied Research and Consulting Group. Tracy studies the sociology of work and the changing nature of work, workers, and the workplace. And she is the author of Bring Work to Life by Bringing Life to Work, and a contributor to Forbes and Fast Company. And you find her on LinkedIn, Twitter, and at tracybrower.com. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I got to apologize for a moment. Steelcase. You work for I only think of them as making office chairs, but they have an applied research and consultancy group. That's really interesting.
Yes,
they make great
absolutely.
Chairs, like really good chairs.
You'd be amazed at what goes into a great work experience.
Yeah,
it's about helping people reach their potential and deep dive research, because it's about really helping people to be their most effective in the work environment and creating a great work experience that's holistic as part of that.
And wow, aren't we in disrupted times right now? I mean, if you talk about where are we working and how are we working when everyone was sent home. And some folks, I'm fortunate this way, I have a great office to work in because I'm often working from home, but many don't. And you think about those great chairs you had at work and this great desk you had at work. And now, do you have that space at home as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is going to be the most significant reinvention of work in our experience, because at a macro level, right? Mm-hmm. Like different industries, different jobs, different regions may be affected differently. But overall, this is causing us to be really intentional about thinking about what works and what doesn't work and what we're eager to get back to in the office. And I think it's an opportunity to accelerate, you know, like not just how do we come back from the pandemic, but how do we make this an opportunity to reimagine and reinvent and really look at things in a new way and maybe a better way than the way that we were looking at them before.
Yeah, I think you're part of this great pandemic series, and I'm so grateful that you're on there. But I think back a few of the shows that we've had in the past, and one of them was a conversation about, now that you're already uncomfortable, why don't we talk about the uncomfortable things? Like that basic argument of that's the way we've always done it is smashed to pieces right now. We are doing things completely differently. So yeah, I love that thought of intentionality. We have an emergent workplace. Now let's make an intentional workplace.
Exactly. Yes, I love that. Now that you're already uncomfortable, where should we go from here?
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I like to say that, you know, like we're most innovative when we're facing the greatest barriers and the greatest limitations. You know, if we're not facing any limitations, we can kind of go along the way we've always done. But the minute we impose lots of barriers and difficulties, we've got to think really differently. We've got to be more creative. We've got to go to a new place that we haven't been before, potentially.
Yeah. And I appreciate your thought that we're never going back. I mean, the biggest thing I think about with it, all of these Zoom, Teams, and so forth calls is like, everybody's seen everybody's home now. Like there's a fundamental shift in the way we think now that we've had, and the pet acceptance and the child acceptance is like, these are fundamental changes in our team relationships that are not going to ever go away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as we think about kind of corporate culture, that bonding is a really big deal. Sociologically speaking, the number one thing that bonds us is to go through really, really difficult times together. Mm-hmm. And this surely qualifies. And we've been invited into people's homes and, you know, we've met their dogs or their kids or their nieces or their partners or whatever. And we've seen our boss with the baseball cap on getting back from the run. And that new level of like intimacy, that new level of humanity is a really good thing. It's going to be interesting when we get back what business casual means, right? Like we all know more about each other now.
Yeah. What does that even mean anymore? It's very funny. And I, you know, early into this, I saw folks talking about, I still dress for work, you know, and then at that did seem to bleed away to some degree. And it's like, have I got pants on?
Exactly. You can't see my fuzzy slippers.
Yeah, you don't know. And I love my slippers. I went and got really good slippers. The Bring Work to Life by Bringing Life to Work, the book. You did not write this with the pandemic in mind. I can't imagine.
I did not. No,
but it seems super salient now because we are rethinking what it means to work.
Yeah, we are. And I think that one of the really interesting things about kind of that idea of bring work to life is the idea of bringing your best. Like, what is it that organizations and leaders can do to create a climate, create a context, create a culture where people feel a sense of psychological safety, where they feel like they have purpose, where they feel like what they do really matters and has value? Those are a really big deal today. And we're starting to kind of rethink where we fit. And so I think it makes a lot of sense in terms of the work-life discussion and the work discussion. And I always say, you know, work is part of a full life. Work is a beautiful thing. We want to feel like we're making a difference. And traditionally, the work-life conversation has been about keep work at bay, keep work away, have a really good boundary. And now we're so immersed in the personal and kind of the home world that a lot of people are saying, you know, I love my people, but I could use a little distance.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to have a little break from my lovely people whom I love.
Need some room there.
It's done this interesting 180 in terms of the discussions about work life and appreciation for the boundary between them, right? Like, people have different preferences for how much separation they put between work and life, and there are multiple right answers.
Yeah.
But some separation can be a really healthy thing.
I recently saw in an email that responded to me on something. At bottom it says, I read and write email at all times. That doesn't mean you have to. If you want to respond during work hours, that's okay with me. Inner footer. Like, wow. That's really interesting. But it also speaks to, there are some folks who really want to, at the proverbial 5 o'clock, disconnect from work and not look at it again until 9. And there's others where I'm most comfortable when it's always flowing.
Right. Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. One of the things we know is that sometimes leaders will, you know, they'll try to be great leaders by taking on the bulk of the work and not letting it flow to their teams. And then they end up working so hard, but then that ends up being kind of a pattern that other people feel like they need to follow.
Right.
And I think that can be very helpful when we're explicit about what those expectations are for others. And when leaders can, through modeling, really kind of set those boundaries for themselves. It's really interesting because sociologically, the number one way that we learn is through watching other people, even if we're not consciously watching and learning.
It's how we learn from our parents. And it makes sense that ultimately, we feel that we are serving a workplace best when we emulate our leaders.
Yes, exactly. And we are logical in doing that because leaders have been promoted, they've been rewarded. Yeah. There's something about that leader that the organization appreciates.
They are the exemplars of success in the organization. So why wouldn't you want to emulate them?
Right.
I mean, it's interesting from the leader's perspective too, to say, especially if you're conscious enough, this idea that other people work other ways most effectively. It's like, there isn't one right way to work. You should work a way that's effective to you, but also with the weight of the consequences of how people will emulate you.
Yeah, I think that's so true.
We're not all Elon Musk, you know? In fact, I'm pretty sure only Elon Musk is Elon Musk.
Indeed.
That kind of constantly working thing is pretty harsh. It comes at a high price.
It does. It comes at a high price. There's a great quote I like. It's something like, comparison is the thief of joy. And I think sometimes we'll be busy comparing ourselves to others, or this work-life dialogue can end up being a bit of a competitive sport. You know, who's working harder? Who's got better balance? Who's figuring it out more effectively? Which is really not so helpful. It's more helpful to know that there are multiple right answers, and life ebbs and flows so much that your right answer this week might be different than next week, or this season different from next season.
Sure.
And for heaven's sakes, when we're living through a pandemic, we got to find some new solutions, and we're all trying to figure it out together.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Daniel Pink's book, Drive. Especially being in the technology field, where he really gets into this, listen, money's not the motivator. Heck, money can be poisonous. That mastery, purpose, and autonomy are the major things. That those three things matter the most. Although I don't think he spends enough time on safety. Like you said it right up front. And on one hand, everyone working from home, that should be inherently safer, except that we're in a pandemic. And so it's hard to feel safe at any time at all.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Actually, we've been thinking a lot of lately about satisfiers and motivators. So Herzberg is a classic sociologist, and satisfiers, he actually researched compensation and says compensation is a satisfier. It's like a great meal.
Right.
You go out for dinner on a Friday night and you leave the restaurant. You're like, oh my gosh, that's the best meal I've ever had. I'm stuffed. I never need to eat again. But by tomorrow lunchtime, you're ready for a sandwich.
Right.
So there are satisfiers. And so as we think about even coming back to the workplace, those are going to be things like cleanliness and distancing and protocols and, you know, temperature checks. They're like going to be table stakes, tickets to entry, right?
Right.
You're going to get me to the office if I know that I've got that level of kind of basic. But then beyond that, what do I need? I need leadership presence and accessibility. Mm-hmm. I need colleagues and connections and community. I need places to focus and places to support my work. So I think it's interesting. I love your point there about kind of what does it take and what are those levels that get us to different places?
Yeah, I like that concept of satisfier. That what I'm trying to do is satisfy your comfort level in a space. You know, as to how often, you know, I think it's really important, not that we clean the space regularly, but it seemed to be cleaned, right? That is more important than, you can say it's clean all day long. It can look clean all day long, but I think you get far more satisfaction from seeing it being cleaned.
Yes, exactly. And there's a new sensory experience and there's a new, I think, consciousness about it. I mean, I've always worked in a clean office.
Sure.
I've never wondered if my office was clean. But the other day I walked in and it just smelled really clean. And I thought, wow, there's just a new consciousness about that. So one of the really interesting things is to think about Maslow, right? Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We all learned about that in high school somewhere. And we worried about the top of the hierarchy, belonging and value and self-actualization.
Sure.
But so many people have been kind of bumped back down to the bottom of that Maslow hierarchy. We're worried about our physiological needs and our
security.
Basic safety and security.
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting to talk to you because we think about like IT security and we think about the security of our health and the security of our workplaces. Mm-hmm. We think about psychological security. There's so many ways we can think about it.
So that ritual of cleaning is part of that satisfaction is really about creating that sense of security if you're going to be in the office. Although a part of that, I think from a leadership perspective, and you've seen this in more and more organizations saying, you don't have to come back to the office. Like you can, you know, I'm also thinking about giving people security just from leadership in the sense that, yeah, you don't have to come back. Don't worry about it. It's okay. Because I've also talked to lots of folks who are like, I need to go back to the office. Like my home environment, for whatever reason, is not a good place to work, or psychologically it isn't working for me, whatever it may be. And so they do care about a good office. It's got to be very stressful for someone who feels unsafe or ineffective for working at home and then is uncomfortable with going to an office.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the really interesting things is I think we've seen this progression. You know, toward the beginning, we were pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. Mm-hmm. We were working hard and we were more productive than we'd ever been. Ha ha.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're hearing now is so many people have hit a wall and they've said, you know, like, I'm doing my best, but I'm feeling a lot of social isolation. I'm ready to get back to my office. I'm ready to get back to work in a way that's more typical in terms of what I've been used to before. So I think that there's this desire to return. And there may also be a desire to continue with some of the cool things that we're able to do now in terms of working from home. But people want that culture. They want that sense of being part of a bigger picture and being part of a team and having that face-to-face relationship with colleagues. So I think that we're seeing that in terms of what people really want.
Do you also see sort of an intentionality around this too? It's like now that you haven't been at work, you're trying to figure out what was it at work that I really needed?
Yeah.
You know, certainly we've had some other conversations where it's like, we're redesigning the workspace because the only reason you come into the office is to be face-to-face with a team. So they need to be sufficiently spaced apart. And it's probably one day a week specifically to do the things that are best served for being in person, which I think is mostly decision-making rather than working, per se? Like, we got to collaborate on some stuff?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that we can say to ourselves, gosh, you know, I really need to be in person when I want to innovate or when I want to create mm-hmm. or co-create or when I want to collaborate, when I want to feel that sense of community. But I think too, you get a certain amount of energy from being together in a physical space. You get a certain amount of feeling of common purpose and camaraderie, which are a big deal. I think the other thing is, I love your point about intentionality. We're being, I think, more intentional about our work. And I have a colleague who says you need to rethink the work before you rethink the workplace, which is right on, right?
Yeah,
like, where am I going to think about doing my best work? And the big deal there is that you may have thought you came to the office for that one meeting. It was a great meeting and you came for the meeting. But really what happened is you ran into that colleague on the way to grab coffee who you wouldn't normally have seen.
Right.
And that was a really big deal.
That water cooler moment.
Yes, work ends up being so braided, you know, like you can't just do all your focused work at home and all your collaborative work in the office.
Right.
You end up kind of going between things. And so coming back together and having the opportunity for that, I think, is a big deal for us.
Yeah, it's just that I can go to the water cooler, but not within 6 feet of you.
Exactly.
And it is interesting to maintain those protocols and keep people just recognizing I'm not going to get good work for folks if they're uncomfortable, and being too close to them right now is uncomfortable. So, I mean, that's interesting all by itself. But I also appreciate this idea that too many things planned. I've started doing calls one-on-one with folks without a plan. Like, literally, I'm going to have coffee at this hour. Would you like to have coffee also? No schedule. And just see what conversation comes out of it. I don't know that it's – the problem is if you're an organized person, like, that doesn't seem efficient. But it's also the way real work goes, is that there are these inefficient things that are important to the way our culture grows.
Right, exactly. One of the things we've noticed is that at the beginning of meetings, there tends to be just a little more chit chat than usual,
yeah.
Right? Just that like connection point, which ends up being really important. Mm. And I think one of the things that's true is like you're staying close to your kind of intimate connections, you're staying close to, and even on video conference, you're staying close to kind of your fundamental connections. There's a great sociologist, Robin Dunbar, who talks about you can maintain relationships at a close level with about 150 people. That's the number of people that you kind of know what's going on with their family or their work or if they're moving their house or
right.
something like that. But it's those secondary and tertiary networks that are harder to stay in touch with. Those are the people where there's a certain amount of efficiency when we're together, right? I can go to the coffee machine and run into Loanne and Keith and Amalia all in 5 minutes or
right.
so and do that catch up. And I don't necessarily have to schedule a half hour with each of them to catch up. But I love your point. Like we need that informal time. We
yeah.
need that unscheduled time. That's what helps us sometimes feel more connected with others.
Absolutely. And Tracy, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. This episode of Run As is brought to you by the new Virtual Dev Intersection and SQL Intersection Workshop event. If you've ever listened to the SQL Q&A shows on Run As, you've heard the fun knowledge and experience of some of the workshop leaders at SQL Intersection. And for the first time ever, the event is going virtual December 9th and 10th. Go to virtual.devintersection.com to register and check out the amazing lineup of workshops. And there will be great keynotes from Scott Guthrie and Charles Manana, and the workshops cover topics including Azure, .NET development, as well as SQL Server-related materials. Spend a few hours and go deep on important topics at virtual.devintersection.com. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Dr. Tracy Brower, a sociologist. And we're talking a bit about, I don't even know really what we're talking about per se, is how the culture of our work is evolving. And again, this sort of opportunity to be intentional about it. And you hinted at this at the first half, that this sort of the sense that folks planned for this to be quick, that they sprinted through this. Don't worry, we're being super productive. We can work from home. This is all going to be great. Like, look, I'm no longer spending time on a commute and so forth. And I really get the sense a few months ago, really, that it exhausted everyone. That now we're finally believing in the long haul, and that this is going to take a while, and it has to be sustainable. And the ones I've seen the most are managers who realize their job is to interact with their team and are just simply on a video call all day long of one form or another. And the one thing they don't want to do at night is go on another video call.
Yes, exactly. I think that leadership role is so important. Like one of the things that we talk about with culture is leaders are so critical, right? Leaders, there's a leadership paradox of culture where culture tends to outlast leaders in long-standing organizations and leaders shape subcultures around them. But there's no room for mediocrity in leadership right now. You know, like you've got to be able to manage by outcomes, manage by objectives, not necessarily by presence. And this is super interesting. There was a study that looked at mental health challenges and stress and anxiety and social isolation. And one of the things that helped people from a mental health standpoint was if they perceived their leader to be empathetic and attentive to their needs, not invasive, but, you know, like asking enough questions that the leader was demonstrating that they care, demonstrating compassion. I think that's pretty cool and interesting and more relevant today probably than otherwise. So that leadership role in culture, that leadership role in, you know, helping us to get through is key. And leaders are going through it themselves, right? Like that's the other crazy thing about this pandemic is we're all going through it together and we're all going to have our own ups and downs.
The mental health issue, I think, is very interesting because we've already started to see a movement before all this happened towards recognizing mental illness as illness, you know, trying to destigmatize it. But we're all under more stress now. I just wonder if one of the benefits of this pandemic will be opening up to the fact that we all have illness at one time or another, some of it in our mind and some not. And that it's not only just okay to talk about it, that it takes time, that it takes care and feeding as well. I just wonder if one of the best things we can do as a leader is to admit where our stressors are lying and that we need time off or that, you know, you got to take that mental health break.
Yeah, absolutely. I did an article about five predictions for the future of work. And one of the predictions is that I think we're going to see companies expand their programming to support people in all kinds of ways. You know, like Steelcase has a terrific model of well-being that's three intersecting circles. And it talks about well-being as holistic. It's physical and emotional and cognitive. And I think we're seeing companies who are in the short term, they're doing things like, you know, I don't know, yoga on Tuesdays with Christine or financial wellness on Thursdays, or hey, we're going to do meditation Monday, that kind of thing. But I think we're going to see those programs continue and we're going to see companies take kind of a broader view of their role in some of those challenges, a broader view of how they support employees in a really holistic way. You know, lots of companies have a gym or a fitness facility, but when they're also offering supports for cognitive well-being and emotional well-being, I think that's going to be a big deal. And I think we're going to see that as a trend because of what we've been going through today.
Right. Yeah. I think it's very powerful. And also just a shakeup of the work structure in general. In some ways, I think technology, especially software development, you know, that sort of mythology that programmers work late at night and so forth. And I, you know, as someone who's been in that space, it's like, listen, mostly we work when we're not interrupted. And that happens to often be late at night, but it also speaks to, because we no longer have the presence option, we're much more interested in measuring people's work by the outcomes. And when you do it exactly, not that important. Like the having that flexibility to care for families, which has sort of been put on us with the pandemic, you just can't ignore that. But I think this is one of the things that's going to persist, that culturally it's like outcomes are the most important thing. Not hours, not even outputs, but outcomes. Can you get to the thing that we needed? And we get better at measuring those things.
Yeah, 100%. It's been interesting because there have been some companies who have been struggling to measure and they want to hold people accountable. Mm-hmm. And with more flexibility, that might seem like it's harder if you're not paying attention to outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen companies who are saying, oh, we need keystroke technology to understand when people are on and how much they're on and what they're doing when they're on. And I think that there's something about maintaining our core values. You know, if a culture is about norms and assumptions and values that are kind of the unwritten rules or the unwritten agreements that we have about how we work together, we don't want to give those away in the pandemic. Like if we weren't a company before who was counting keystrokes, let us not go there now. Let us make sure that we're really staying true to values.
Yeah. And how is that going to benefit them? In software, again, there was this thing called the K-lock or thousand line of code. You know, who is the most K-lock? And if you went down that path, it turned out everybody wrote more code. It didn't mean it worked, just that they wrote more of it. And exactly. If you start measuring keystrokes, if keystrokes are a rate of success, I guarantee you more keystrokes. I don't know if they're going to help you, but you'll get more of them.
That's right. You will get what you measure. Yeah. That is a truism.
Yeah. And so, and I jumped to the end game with that whole, that I care about the outcome, not the output. But I got that from working in disaster response, where there's lots of outputs, but the outcomes are more questionable. But it's such a salient thing because it also gets away from the tools. Use the tools that make sense. Like every tool is now open to you if all you focus on is that outcome, that customer benefit side. Now, again, we're starting to strip away these things and say, yeah, it may be hard to measure, but they're the things that actually matter. So if we measure those things, then ultimately we'll be better off.
Yeah. And, I think accountability is an interesting conversation when we think about culture. There's a great mantra that I like, that a culture is significantly determined by the worst behavior it will tolerate. Isn't that lovely?
That is lovely.
Every now and then you run into a company and they say, yeah, we know so-and-so is kind of difficult to work with, but he gets such great results, but it sends a message to the rest of the culture.
Yes, results at any price.
It results at what price? Precisely. So cultures are so about behaviors. Mm-hmm. You're not managing a culture per se. Culture is the accumulation of behavior over time.
Right.
And so what we're managing is behavior. We're encouraging, discouraging, selecting, deselecting for certain behaviors that we want. And I think that there's an opportunity to have kind of a common language with culture. Like our language of business tends to be financial, right? We talk about the balance sheet or what was the return on that investment? And, did I have a big cost associated with that project, both literally and figuratively? And the more we talk about culture as a language of the way that we interact, the better. You bring it to the surface. You make it more explicit. Mm-hmm. And that helps from an accountability standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, so that people know what is it that we want around here in terms of behavior and what goes around here.
Yeah, not money at any price. An interesting side effect of this is that a thriving culture tends to produce more anyway and is defended in its own right. That you come to value the culture that you're in so much that you want, you're automatically wanting the business to succeed because it helps grow that culture too. It becomes its own force. I mean, and I've certainly been in businesses that were like that, where they love the business. And it's not that they love the technology we made. It's that it was the group of people and how they interacted.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the misnomers of culture can be that there are good cultures or bad cultures. Yeah. And I think culture is really about alignment. It's alignment between what kind of culture do you need within your market, for your competitors, for your customers. The culture you need at a tech firm is really different than the culture you need at an oil and gas company.
Sure.
There are fundamentals of constructive, productive culture.
Yeah.
But the nature of the way those plays out, play out can be different. I think the really interesting thing through the pandemic is what we've learned about culture. Because the other thing about culture match is that my great culture that I thrive in might be really different than yours.
For sure.
And people are learning about their cultures. Like they're saying, I thought we were really nimble and agile, but oh my goodness, through the pandemic, I'm learning that not so much. Or people are saying, I always knew we were pretty transparent about communication, but we have really risen to the occasion and we are really demonstrating transparency and great detailed communicate, right? So there are interesting surprises that you might learn about your culture through difficult times.
Yeah, this is that whole, character is not made during the crisis, character is shown during the crisis.
Exactly.
And I mean, in my experience, most organizations I've worked with have stood up during the crisis, that their characters were really quite strong. Even though they may have been lackadaisical about them in the less stressful times, when the chips went down, they tended to do the right things. And we've been fortunate in that respect. I'm sure it's not true everywhere. I hope it is, but I expect that there are worse places and better places. Hard times are hard times.
Absolutely.
But it is interesting to think about the much more intentional reinforcement of culture. I appreciate the statement of it is the behavior we will tolerate or accept. Except that it's negative. That's fundamentally, it's like, where do we say no? Where do we draw a line? Which I certainly appreciate. It's like, what's the positive side of culture? What do we celebrate? What do we stand up on?
Right. Right. Yeah, like exactly.
In the DevOps culture, we've gotten big on this idea of the one who stands up and says, here's the failure. I was a part of it. Here's how we're learning from it. And that is celebrated, that you acknowledge yes. where mistakes are made, not that they are career limiting things, but they are how we actually get better. And I think that's really hard for a lot of folks.
Yeah, for sure. I used to work with a brilliant leader and he used to say, you know, like, if I see you bring me dashboards mm-hmm. on our, you know, weekly update and I see only greens, something's wrong.
Yeah.
Either you're not being honest with me because I know there have to be some yellows and reds in there, or we're not trying hard enough.
Right.
We're not stretching hard enough. There's a cool exercise that we do in engagement sometimes where we ask people to think about their organizational culture and we think about organizational heroes. So we'll say, okay, if you're at your company and you kind of look across the work cafe and you see somebody and you say, oh, that person is totally the embodiment of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
What's that person like?
Yeah.
You know, like describe that person, their pros, their cons, their strengths, their weaknesses. And that is an interesting way to think about your culture. Like those are also the characteristics or attributes of your organizational culture. And it's helpful to think about them in human terms. And I love your point, right? Like we learn about individual character and we learn about organizational culture sure. and character through difficult times.
I'm thinking technologically. So clearly I'm up against my own experiences here. It's like, how often is the hero the one who pulled the all-nighter?
Yes.
And it's like, is that really something we want to celebrate? Like that should not have been necessary. And it's fundamentally unhealthy. Like I don't want to diminish that person, but I don't think I want to celebrate that either. Like it's a mistake. I don't want to tell you the best way you serve this company is to work right through the night. Like that seems unwise.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that's the other thing about culture. We manage it best when we're super aware of what's not working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we've really got to understand how we can consistently be evaluating and assessing it, closing some of those gaps, and thinking about how individuals can have a role in that. Process is a really important part too,
sure.
right? Like there's the individual role related to culture. And the individual influence that all of us have so that we should feel empowered because of that individual influence. And process is a piece as well. Like if we can really assess what's not working and then be able to find those process solutions so we don't have to have that person pulling an all-nighter, that's a really big deal.
Yeah. Well, that idea that the price can be too high.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about the complexity of culture, it's like it can't just be about the money. It can't just be that ultimately we delivered it successfully.
Right.
What was the price we paid for the deliverable? Was it too high?
Right.
You know, also often in software, it says, doesn't matter that it was over budget and a year late. It worked. It's like, no, it kind of does matter. We should have been able to estimate that better. It's only because software tends to have such high returns that we can afford to blow that much money to be that wrong. But software has such returns that you can tolerate that. There's a lot of other industries where that wouldn't work. Actually, virtually every other industry where that wouldn't work. You doubled the cost of something. Now it's not a viable product. Software somehow sneaks away from that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of interesting to me that I think software has driven different expectations in society, right? Mm-hmm. Like we used to buy something and think that it was going to work. It was going to work the first time and it was going to work forever.
Yeah.
And now we buy something and we're ready for the rev and we're ready for the software update and we're ready for it to not work because we need the next update.
Yeah. Right. And we expect that update frequently. I mean, rather than expect it to always work, it's like, no, I kind of expect it won't work, but I'll be annoyed it doesn't get updated every week.
Exactly.
Really? Okay.
Exactly. Our expectations have changed
so much.
One of the things that I think is relevant to our conversation is I always say that if you start with people and do the right thing for people, the business will follow.
Right.
The right things will happen for the business, right? So this point you were making about like results at any cost or money at any cost and what are we doing in terms of burning people out in the mm-hmm. process? I think we do the right thing for people and they want to give discretionary effort. They are engaged, they are inspired, and then they do their best work. So there's that relationship, I think, of where we start and where we want to end. I mean, we want to keep the end in mind, obviously. We're, you know,
we need many, outcomes many or we
organizations
won't be
there. Are for-profit businesses.
For sure.
But when we do the right thing for people, we can be even more profitable, I think.
Yeah, it is very interesting to sort of balance those two things too. And the discretionary time is an awesome one because at the same time, you've got to also look at someone and go, I appreciate you all the extra effort you're putting in, but I believe you're burning yourself out. Like, I need you for the long haul, not just the short haul. I'm not resistant to sprints either. The sprints are fun. And funny, we are literally living this with the pandemic. We sprinted the first part of this pandemic. We know it's now it's going on and we're starting to sort of settle into the long haul effects, how we want things to work, where things are ultimately going to go, and that we're never going back. And we sort of had a metaphor in these past few months of modern culture.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And isn't it true that when you are sprinting, your body burns energy differently? Mm-hmm. And then when you get into a marathon process, like you cross a certain mileage threshold, and then your body starts burning differently and uses energy differently. And I think that's where we're at, right? This is about, we figured out we're in it for the long haul,
we're in the
and
marathon.
We need to make it work for each other, for ourselves and for each other.
Yeah. And a whole new set of, there's a bunch of things we could ignore during the sprint. We can't ignore these things during the marathon. And now we've got to be intentional about all these parts. And I guess culture is one of them. Really, I wonder how many organizations just have never had a conversation about their culture. Sort of really taught, you know, the number of times I've seen the stories of we need to write a vision statement and all those sorts of things, really just manifestations of culture. And lots of folks poo-poo it, sort of walk away. But here we are in this marathon. Time to talk about your culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And it drives so much of our decision making, right? So the more we can be clear about what we want that culture to be, I think the more clear we can be about then how it guides us in the decision making that we make and the ways that we support people over time. So it's a really great point.
Awesome point. Tracy, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and happily going to provide some links to the books and your great TED Talk. It seems prescient today, the way you were talking about how we work and making work healthier, because we're clearly struggling for that now.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate our conversation.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.